Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. Today is Friday, February the 28th, and we are here to talk about very fast-moving developments involving the war in Ukraine and how Europe and the European Union are going to respond to it. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined today by my Bruegel colleagues, Guntram Wolf and Heather Graby. We are looking at, on Saturday, so before this podcast is published, a meeting of European leaders, many of them, in London with Keir Starmer, the UK Prime Minister, and also Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky. And then on March the 6th, the EU and Zelensky will be having a summit in Brussels. The framework for that summit is, what are we prepared to do about Ukraine? What is the European Union prepared to pay for and come together to do? What sort of collective action can be taken? Heather, how important are these meetings and what's possible now?
These meetings are all about redefining the alliances. So it's redefining NATO with the US not engaged in the way it has been as the anchor and the hegemon in NATO right since the beginning. That's a huge change. And the meeting on Sunday in London that Keir Starmer will host is really important in defining what kind of NATO alliance there is now. There will be 13 NATO members there, by my count, including Norway and Turkey, but without those who've blocked aid to Ukraine and have expressed support for Russia, notably Hungary and Slovakia. And Zelensky will be there. So this is really about finding who's in on support for Ukraine and trying to define how to move forward. And it's really notable that Starmer is hosting this quite remarkable thing. It shows how the geopolitical realignments of the past couple of weeks are starting to solidify with turbo boosting of EU-UK relations and definitely a separating off of the security and defence issues from the wider relationship. I think that's definitely now going to move ahead on a different track. But it also means European allies really talking the hard things, talking about money in particular. That's going to be the most difficult and most important and contentious issue in the short term. And then longer term about defence, both their own defence, but also defending Ukraine.
Guntram, what kind of money do we need? Sounds like aid for Ukraine to keep its economy going, military aid for Ukraine, defense equipment for the EU, defense forces, defense sort of action by the EU to consider what it would do under various scenarios, and working with people in the neighborhood. How do we think about this and what is needed?
Let me just say there's lots to talk about, and money is indeed a central part of it, but it's not only about money, right? I mean, I think the first thing that leaders really have to agree on is, what is it that we want? I mean, what is our strategy? I mean, where do we want to go? What do we want to achieve? Do we want Ukraine to win or not to win? Do we want to ensure the security of the continent country by country, or do we want to have more collaboration? Do we want to procure certain weapon systems together, or do we want to continue having a fragmented approach? And all of this is then intermingled with the discussion on money and how many resources. The Ukraine bit at some level is almost the easy bit in the sense that the support given to Ukraine is, in fact, from a macroeconomic point of view, relatively small. I mean, when we are talking about the military support that the United States is providing to Ukraine, we're talking of a number of 0.1% or so of EU GDP. I mean, economically per year, economically, macroeconomically, it should be totally feasible for Europe to step in and replace the United States should the United States decide to fully withdraw from Europe. What is more difficult is to replace the United States if it was to withdraw from all of the security of the continent, not just from Ukraine. I mean, then we are talking about around 100,000 U.S. troops, a bit less than 100,000 U.S. troops in Europe, plus what war scenarios tell us is that at the moment NATO thinks that we will have up to 100,000 or 200,000 additional U.S. soldiers coming to Europe in case of a real war or a real confrontation between a NATO EU country and Russia. So we are basically talking about a major military and financial effort if we wanted to replace the U.S. fully, and that in a very short period of time.
What role is U.S. policy having on all of this? We've had President Donald Trump talking about having meetings with Russia, talking about the U.S. brokering a peace, not necessarily with European input. What should we make of these comments?
Well, as ever, you have to see which of the many statements Trump throws out there he actually follows up on. There's no question that this is a major change in the U.S. to express trust in Putin and to talk about doing a deal with Putin over the heads of both the Ukrainians and the Europeans, which is fundamentally about European security and the future of a large country on the European continent. But having said that, there are longer term secular trends which were there in US politics, which Europeans were perhaps slow to pick up on, but which now really we have to reckon with even after the Trump presidency. There's been less interest of US leaders on both parties in Europe, the pivot to Asia famously under Barack Obama, much more concern about the Indo-Pacific as a security theater, more of a concern, again, in both parties that Europe should take care of its own defense, both financially and also in terms of capabilities. These are things that would have been there even if Kamala Harris had won, and where there's been pressure from the US for some time. What's happened now is that suddenly it's having to be faced by the Europeans in a very short time period. And notions like, for example, strategic autonomy, which France has been pushing for a very long time in Europe, start to become really real. They're not just about a nice slogan and some nice ambitions, but they're things that have to be financed. And they're things that have to take money and political attention away from other priorities in order to go to them. So Europe is facing trade-offs between its security needs and many other needs, which are much harsher and require really a fundamentally collective response. And that's a collective response both within the EU, but also within NATO. The UK, Norway, Turkey are not comfortable with the current situation, to say the least. So this question that Guntram put forward about, are we going to procure weapon systems together? Are we going to do security country by country or collaboratively? These used to be no-brainer questions. But now they're ones that have to be answered very quickly and without much time to reflect on what kind of trade-offs are made against other priorities.
What do you think, Guntram?
Well, I mean, I fully agree with the sort of long-term secular trend of the United States that Heather described. I would say what happens now, however, is not only an acceleration of that trend, but it really took on a qualitatively different dimension in the sense that President Trump openly calls President Zelensky a dictator. He openly votes with Russia in the United Nations Security Council. And he openly negotiates with Putin without involving the Europeans. So basically, almost in Yalta manner, so the big heads talking and dividing up Europe without regard to European powers. So basically selling out European interests. So I think we are really at a point where the break is much more fundamental than the long-term secular trend would have suggested and would have been necessary. I fundamentally don't think this is in the U.S. interest. I think the U.S. basically is undermining its own interests, Trump's policy also domestically is fundamentally putting a question mark on American democracy and is undermining European American democracy. So we are really in a new world, which I think is very, very dangerous for Europe. And so, look, I mean, on the military side, I do think the answer, of course, is that defending the continent will be not only much cheaper, but also much more effective if we do it collectively, right? And so that answer, let's say, from a theoretical point, is easy to make. What we have to do now is talk about it in very practical terms, right? And do this in a very short period of time. So put differently, I mean, suppose the US troops in Poland get withdrawn in a relatively short period of time. Who puts additional troops to Poland? And, you know, who equips these troops? And how is the funding organized of this replacement? I think these are the kind of practical questions. In my study for Bruegel and the Kiel Institute, we come up with numbers of, I mean, basically up to 300,000 soldiers plus equipment need to be procured and hired and need to work really effectively in a collectively organized organization. And that requires major increases in funds. We think easily an increase of 1.5% of GDP of the EU would be necessary. That's I mean, 250 billion is a little bit less than that. So we are talking of 250 billion or above for the EU as a whole. I would personally imagine to put half of that money at the member state level. So member states need to raise their own funds and increase their military capabilities. But I would really think we need roughly half for joint procurements for the so-called strategic enablers, which are basically systems that currently only the US provides to NATO and that would have to be replaced. So that's information systems, satellite communication, certain air defense capabilities, air transport capabilities, missiles, so drones, so things we don't have in enough quantity at the national level. So that kind of stuff, I would really hope we can buy it collectively to bring down costs and really reap the benefits of a large European market.
And this is especially tricky because there are choices to be made about what kinds of capabilities to invest in. And there isn't time for a long strategic defense review and a long discussion among the member states to come to an agreement on that. So, for example, should Europe be investing in the kinds of weaponry which, you know, traditionally were there for territorial defense, so things like tanks, or should it be protecting against drones, which are incredibly important on the battlefield and where we see an evolution month by month in Ukraine in both the technology used and also the kinds of capabilities that are needed, for example, jamming devices and so on. Should we be investing for an old-fashioned kind of land war or much more of a drone war? Or should we also be investing in avoiding the kind of hybrid attacks that Russia is already conducting on the European continent and which could be ramped up dramatically? So things like attacks on undersea infrastructure, like all these cutting of cables that's been going on, or trying to ensure that factories with defense equipment in them are sufficiently protected, or infrastructure on offshore wind. These are the kinds of things where Russia has already been doing a lot of sabotage. We've seen attempts to scare local populations. For example, recent claims about the way that Russia has perhaps even been paying agents to conduct attacks in German towns in the run-up to the election. This was a discussion in the German Parliament's Intelligence Committee yesterday. So are these the kinds of things that we should be investing in because Russia can undertake that kind of hybrid warfare on European territory, even if there isn't an open conflict? So these are a lot of different kinds of civilian or kind of dual use technologies and capabilities that European countries need to invest in. And we haven't seen the kind of political consensus around this that would also bring the public along. People are aware of the threat. People are very, very aware of the headlines from Trump. But there are different threat perceptions in the member states of what kinds of threats are most important. You know, if you live in the Baltic states or Poland, if you're on the Russian border, you might really be very concerned about a land invasion. Whereas if you live in Spain, you might be concerned about quite different things. So the need to bring countries together, both in terms of their strategic analysis of the threats, decisions about what to invest in, and persuading the public, this is all happening very, very quickly. And it will take some time for them, probably longer than we would like, to come to decisions.
In the next part of our podcast, I'd like to spend some time specifically on joint European spending. We have seen the EU go from a fairly small central budget that mostly paid for administration, agriculture subsidies, and some research and development type of functions to a huge and existential debate about fiscal backstops during the euro sovereign debt crisis, and then a less contentious but even more financially significant effort to respond to the coronavirus pandemic in 2020. Now we are looking at, perhaps unthinkably, Europeans seriously talking about whether to borrow together to buy weapons together or look at funding for something that, at least from the big picture, looks a lot like a European army. Gunther, are you surprised by this? I had always thought that Europe would be more likely to fund an electricity grid to free up money to spend nationally on weapons. But the idea that we would be talking as seriously as we are, the Commission and the Council and the member states, about borrowing together for weapons, that seems huge to me.
Oh, absolutely. It is huge. I mean, we are, I think, really speaking again in historical terms here. I mean, what we are observing is really history in the making. And I think the old saying that Europe moves ahead and comes together at moments of existential threat. I mean, that saying, I think, is probably correct and captures it quite well. I mean, I think the first point that I think we need to really answer is, to what extent do we think should additional military expenditure be funded by deficits, right, by issuing debt? And there, my answer is, you know, as an economist, is really that in the short term, such an increase needs to and should be funded by deficits. And there's really two reasons why that is the case. I mean, the first is a simple economic reason. If you, in the very short term, raise taxes massively or you cut spending elsewhere, that involves significant costs to the economy. Tax smoothing and consumption smoothing arguments call for additional debt. The second economic reason is that some of this equipment that you are buying is really going to be useful, not just for a year or two, but really for decades, hopefully. So in other words, these kind of long-term stuff needs to be funded from an economic perspective with a deficit. The second reason is, of course, a political one. I mean, it's simply unthinkable that within 1 year, we would go and slash our social budgets to those numbers. So in the end of the day, we will need debt, and the debt will be particularly important in the beginning. In a few years' time, we will have to manage to reshuffle budgets so that defense spending moves up and, you know, well exceeds the 2% threshold. I would say it should be more than 3%. But that's a medium-term development, not a short-term development. And so the question is, if you have all that debt, I mean, do you fund it and do you issue it at the national level or at the European level? And that's where we have a big discussion. I think in the end, we will have both. At the national level, the constraints are the national fiscal rules and in some countries, the national sort of ratings, which might not be that good anymore. And at the European level, the constraints are basically political and legal constraints. So what is it that the European Union can do in terms of borrowing? Well, it probably will need a unanimous decision to borrow. And on what can it spend? And there is a big legal discussion whether the treaties would allow to spend EU money on defense related products. So that's the big debate here. And I would say my last word on the European level, there's of course then also discussion to move outside of the EU treaties and do it in an intergovernmental vehicle, perhaps ideally even including the United Kingdom and Norway, but then drop some countries that might be less willing to participate, such as Hungary or perhaps even Slovakia. So that's, I would say, broadly where the debate is at the moment.
Could you see another European stability mechanism forming? You talk about intergovernmental. We've seen Europe build these outside institutions, and it's pretty complicated.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So if one wanted to do an intergovernmental mechanism, it would have to be really quite an established institution such as the ESM. Otherwise, Eurostat rulings would not allow that debt to be taken off the books of the member states. So in other words, we are really talking about the creation of something quite complicated that requires paid in capital. It requires, I think, a serious attempt to have credibility in financial markets, etc., etc. So it's not something that you just do without anything. It needs a lot of investment from the member states. And of course, it will call on particularly the strong, fiscally strong member states to do something about it. The good news here is that the fiscally strong member states are basically the ones that are pretty exposed to the Russian threat, right? I mean, it's basically everybody north and east from Germany onwards, right? That is particularly exposed. And most of these countries actually have relatively low debt to GDP ratios. And, you know, these countries, of course, will think about whether it makes sense for them to do it collectively, where the advantage is basically procurement efficiencies and larger orders. But the disadvantage may in fact be that the borrowing is more expensive at the EU level at the special purpose vehicle level than if you just issue your own bunds. So I think that's going to be a big trade-off that will be debated.
What about doing collective procurement, which has some precedent for big ticket items like airplanes that involve some of these EU and non-EU members, but where the financing still comes nationally? Is that more practical?
It's possible. Of course, it's possible. But of course, also member states will feel quite awkward transferring money from their own budget somewhere in a common pot and then losing control over it. So it might be easier for member states if some central mechanism borrows and it doesn't go through the national budgets.
But then who owns the planes or the troops or the assets?
Yeah, that's another question that isn't answered. So basically, in the current construction, the procurement could be done jointly, but then the planes would have to be delivered to the national armies. I mean, we wouldn't create an planes run by the European Commission or anything of that sort, because basically there's neither a political nor a legal base on which you could sort of have an EU army running planes. I mean, that is something that is at this stage, I would say, completely utopian.
So Heather Guntram mentioned the need for unanimity when the EU27 borrow together. What is the current state of unanimous consent for stuff in Europe? Is it something that is constantly fraught because of resistance from Hungary and others? Is it something where only on certain issues do we expect real showdowns? How big of a problem is this?
It's been a constant problem since the beginning of the war after Russia invaded Ukraine. There was initially a strong consensus and it was possible to get sanctions on Russia. And those are still in place. And there was initially consensus on sending support to Ukraine. But then what we've seen over the past years is that then particularly the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has then sought to link his agreement to further support to Ukraine to getting concessions on specific issues, particularly about the conditionality on funds to Hungary itself because of misspending problems. So this problem of holding agreement hostage to other issues is what the member states will be seeking to overcome. But then there's the other side, which is wanting to bring in non-EU countries, particularly the UK and Norway, which are very much allied on the security side, but also have, in the case of the UK, significant defence industry, as well as, of course, very significant defence assets. What nobody in Europe has is the logistics that the US has been providing. So military transport, air-to-air refueling and all these kinds of things. So these are new areas where actually, you know, buying the equipment is itself complex because it's not available necessarily from European defense companies. And then there's the tricky issue of whether member states want to favour their own defence companies with contracts. Because if you're going to do joint procurement, which is much more efficient, you've got larger contracts and you've got better negotiating power, then really you need to buy from the best supplier at the best price, regardless of whether, even if that's a European supplier, let alone the idea of kind of spreading out the contracts across the continent. So there are all these kinds of issues which will be in play for the member states as they discuss it. But the main thing in overcoming the unanimity problem, it's partly that it's difficult to do at EU level, particularly because of Orban's behaviour, but it's also really wanting to bring in the others. So that's the idea of the special purpose vehicle, especially because then you could have something which is potentially off balance sheet for member states and which really brings in the countries, the coalition of the willing, which is most interested.
So the blessing and the curse of the EU's unanimity rules is that the smaller member states all have an equal voice to the bigger member states. What we've seen in special purpose vehicles is that the biggest member state or states has the veto and everyone else has to sort of go along. Even if consensus is the way things are done, moving to any sort of majority voting in all of these contexts is very fraught. So in principle, whoever's got the veto is the person controlling the consensus. With the ESM, no decision was possible without German support because Germany controlled a big enough share of the capital to have a say there. How would that work for something on defense? Who would have the most capital and how would that dynamic play out? Who would our big players be? It would seem to me that if you involve European countries, Germany, Norway, the UK, and perhaps others like Iceland or maybe even Turkey, you could have a situation where the capital is put in by countries that look a lot different from the countries that wield the biggest influence within the EU. That would be very difficult to build consensus around for making decisions, to say nothing of the financial liability. But if you have the UK and Germany both holding the majority of financial responsibility for something, why would the smaller member states do this? What's in it for them?
But look, I think the question goes well beyond the financial side that you describe. I think the real question is who will take the leadership of the continent, right? And at the moment, for the last decades, it has de facto been the United States when it came to big geostrategic questions, right? I mean, yes, there was agency of Germany. Yes, there was agency of France. Yes, there was agency of the UK. But, you know, at the end of the day, banging the heads together and sort of telling you, let's get your act together and solve the issue, That was done by the US administration. And by the way, also in the Eurozone crisis, I mean, the number of times that the US Treasury Secretary attended the Eurogroup meeting and basically was telling people, no, guys, it's not a good idea to let the euro blow apart. That was really very often. And so so this is the question. Now that the United States is gone, or if it's really permanently gone, who's taking the leadership? And, you know, historically, it's very clear that Germany, of course, cannot be just any other country because it's bigger than the others. But at the same time, it's also clear that Germany cannot do the leadership on its own and shouldn't do it on its own. And so I think the Friedrich Merz, the possible next chancellor, in my mind, has sent the right signals at the moment by saying, OK, I mean, the first thing I will do is really sit together with Poland and France, and then, of course, also the UK. And we will have to find a way of collectively leading the continent. And, you know, on the big security issues, I'm afraid it's always going to be the big states that that will drive the discussion, and not the very small ones. But you're right. One has to then think about mechanisms that get the smaller member states on board. But the key is really, I mean, we will need some strategic leadership of this continent, and how the strategic leadership will look like, I don't know exactly. It's clear that no member state in the EU alone can do it. It will have to be somehow collectively organized. Germany will play an overproportional role, but it will not be the only one. And I think France will play a really, really big role, because in security terms, France and the UK are, I would say, probably more advanced in strategic thinking than Germany is. So I think it's really going to be quite an interesting thing to observe.
I think we should also remember the words of Paul-Henri Spaak, a Belgian prime minister, who remarked many decades ago, all countries in Europe are small now. The difference is between those who know it and those who don't. This crisis has put into perspective a lot of issues which, you know, had been ignored for a long time. It's not just about size of member states, I think, Guntram, I would take you up on that. It's also about their capabilities, different kinds of capabilities. So, as you say, France, because of its strategic military capabilities, and of course, you know, it's also a nuclear power, which Germany is not. So France and the UK are really fundamental on defence capabilities in ways that Germany is not. But when it comes to fiscal firepower, that is not France, that is Germany. But it's also some of the frugal member states, as they used to be. They're no longer so frugal, at least on defence. So it's more the northern and eastern ones. And really, the fact that we are all small means that we all have to pull together. So this question of strategic leadership is something that I don't think won't depend on the size of member state. It will depend on the clarity of vision and willingness also to find a way through to managing Trump for the next 4 years. This is going to be extremely difficult, because remember, we're only a month in, and think of all the things that have happened. And I think some of the smaller member states have actually done really well in having a clarity of vision on the crisis. The Baltics, for example, you know, are now supplying the High Representative for Foreign and Security Policy, as well as the Defence Commissioner, you know, and they have been warning for a very long time about the threats from Russia and the dangers of dependency on, for example, Russian gas, which then Germany only belatedly realised when the conflict began. So I think this is where Europe pulling together is not just a nice slogan of unity and diversity and all these things we like to say in Europe. It's now a strategic necessity. And I think the leadership will need to come from individual leaders. It's not necessarily by country, especially because, you know, the government at the moment in Paris is weak domestically, and Germany, it hasn't been formed. So there's a need also for really good thinking.
As we move into the last part of our podcast, I'd like to think a little bit further out about what Europe could look like after this historic reshuffling. We're looking, of course, at historic spending, historic military changes, and also EU enlargement. We've heard that Ukraine possibly could become an EU member state by 2030, was one idea that has been thrown out. Norway, which has historically remained independent, likewise is looking, I think, more seriously in some circles, at least, about formally joining the EU. This would bring Norway much closer to the decision-making, which could be interesting depending on how much money they're putting forward. But also, as we've discussed earlier on this podcast and other episodes, Ukraine joining would have a huge effect on the workforce, the economy, the shape of aid to all the member states. Would you offer any thoughts for how to think that through and a timeline for when any decisions might be made or when the urgency might recede? What could lead to that?
Enlargement has always been a push-pull between the geopolitical urgency of bringing countries into the European fold and against all of the domestic interests, which are in favor of keeping things as they are, maintaining the status quo. And that geopolitical urgency is what pushed forward Ukraine and Moldova's candidacy and then the start of negotiations with them. And I think that will continue to press. The big question is about what kind of security relationship there is across Europe, because historically, countries have joined NATO first and then they've joined the EU later, not in the case of Sweden and Finland, but since the 2004 enlargements. That was always the case. So the security issues were resolved before EU membership, whereas now we're faced with the prospect of perhaps the US ruling out membership of NATO for Ukraine, as Trump has done recently, and also all kinds of security complications which the EU has never had to deal with in enlargement before. Everything from martial law to potentially, you know, lines of control and not all of the country's territory being under the control of the government in Kiev. All kinds of issues like that. So the enlargement question is much more geopolitical than it was before. I think 2030 for Ukraine would be pretty optimistic, simply because joining the EU is not only a geopolitical issue. There's also the 200,000 pages of EU law to adopt and implement and so on. And for a large country which is at war, that's pretty difficult to do, despite the great efforts that actually the Ukrainians have made. It's quite impressive what they've done so far. But even so, it's a very tall order. But certainly bringing in some of the Balkan countries to show that the EU is open for enlargement, to do that before 2030 would be quite helpful. And I think the Norway question is a really interesting, Rebecca. I'm glad you raised that, because I've noticed this as well, how many Norwegian business people, as well as those in the political classes, are now thinking about, should we go back to the Norwegian people on this question? They rejected EU membership in a referendum, and that's why Norway didn't join in 1995, along with Sweden and Finland. But by now, and particularly with, you know, Jens Stoltenberg back in Norway after his term at NATO, and a shifting domestic debate, and Norway's gas no longer being the asset that it was, these are all factors that could push Norway towards joining, and that would help a lot on the security side. It would help with the fiscal side, given Norway's position, and that would be a different kind of enlargement that I think could give some momentum to the rest.
Gunther?
No, I don't think I have much to add. I mean, I think the timeline, as Heather pointed out, would be very ambitious. The key question I think that will first have to be resolved is the security of Ukraine, right? And I think that's where I would focus my attention on now. I mean, how can we make sure that Ukraine gets what it needs in terms of weapon, in terms of financial support, in terms of material? And of course, also in terms of intelligence and other aid. And then the much more difficult debate is if there was to be some sort of a peace agreement, you know, what kind of guarantees can one sensibly provide? And there, I mean, just to make the point, it's not going to be enough to send a symbolic amount of troops, I mean, 10,000 troops or something like that to Ukraine. I mean, that's not gonna solve the issue unless one is really ready to back that up with credible guarantees that if ever these 10,000 get touched, I mean, we are basically going to send in much more troops. And of course, that's then a very difficult discussion because many member states rightly fear that that would mean a direct confrontation between core European countries and Russia. And that's, I think, really what we need to avoid at this point. So I would say my gut feeling is there will be a big focus on support for Ukraine. I think we will have to arm Ukraine to the teeth, really give them all they need. But I think the issue of sending troops is going to be extremely difficult. And what I could see is troops in Western Ukraine, but I think the political red lines will be very big, sending troops really into the core of Ukraine where they could be directly attacked. So I think all of that is going to be the key focus in the next months and years probably. And yes, the EU membership is extremely important to anchor Ukraine's economic perspectives into Western Europe and make sure that they have a future, right? I mean, that's the key. And the economic future will come only if they continue to have to be well integrated into Western Europe. And that's, in a sense, the promise that has to be given to Ukrainian citizens that, yes, we will make sure that you join and that hopefully you will see an economic miracle like the one that Poland experienced in the last 30 years with one of the highest growth rates in all of Europe.
You mentioned the possibility of sending troops into Ukraine to fight alongside Ukrainian forces. At the same time, we've been hearing talks about possible settlements. Heather, is anything possible at this point? What do you think is going to be the focus in the next couple of months?
The big focus is whether the US and Russia can and will do any kind of deal. We've seen some very warm words at the opening and with this first meeting in Riyadh of the officials to prepare talks. But let's not forget that Putin has always rejected the idea of an interim ceasefire. He may well see it as in his advantage to continue fighting in the next months. He could end up frustrating Trump very much by asking for things that Trump is not prepared to give or by refusing to move to a ceasefire. So I think we're still a long way from coming to a deal where Europeans would feel comfortable putting troops into Ukraine, and that wouldn't be to fight, that would be to police the ceasefire. Possibly other countries would come in there too. It's not impossible to imagine a UN-mandated peacekeeping force of some kind. Remember that both the US and Russia are on the Security Council. And if, say, you know, Chinese peacekeepers were involved, that could bring in another Security Council member. So there's a lot that can happen over the next months around this deal, which may or may not involve troops on the ground. But it would very much be around policing the ceasefire rather than European troops fighting in Ukraine.
Listeners, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a particularly specific moment in time. We are recording just a few days before we release this podcast, so hopefully most of what we've said today will be relevant. Thank you so much for joining The Sound of Economics. Gunter Wolf, Heather Graby, I'm Rebecca Christie. You can find their writings on Ukraine and on defense spending and on Europe at our website, Bruegel.org. Podcast is here on all of your favorite podcast channels, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, and our own website, of course. Thanks for listening and see you next time.